The commitment of members to their organization and organizational commitment to its members is an important ongoing discussion that I have covered both in this program and in the main Talking About Organizations podcast. In this episode, I want to further discussion about the member's side. Traditionally, the construct has been about the member as a single individual, when in practice, we're talking about the member's family as well, or other dependents that the member is required to support. So how does this change the conversation on the organization side? What is the organization's commitment to the members' families? My name is Tom Galvin, and these are my reflections on management. This is a very touchy subject, obviously, because the worker has a great deal of emotional and vested interest in caring for the family. But it has not always been the case that the burden or the responsibility for providing for the needs of the member has gone beyond the member, that society or organizations have had such a responsibility. Like to offer just a shining example of what I'm talking about, and this goes back to my days in the U.S. military. And an old jape that was out there before I joined the service, the quote, if the Army wanted you to have a wife, it would have issued you one. This sort of attitude, I think, was prevalent a bit more in those days when the male was the breadwinner and the female or the wife basically ran the household. But more to the point, the burden of caring for the family fell upon the breadwinner, and the organization's commitment was relatively low by comparison to today. I mean, now the expectations are that it is more than the individual's responsibility to provide for the needs of the members' families or other dependents, such as aging parents or aging relatives who are living with the member. So, you know, before when I discussed organizational commitment, I was kind of focused on the individual. The families were a bit peripheral, or semi-included, but not focused on when I discussed an episode with the main podcast, where I discussed the example of Milton Hershey and what he did to build the town, now city of Hershey, of Pennsylvania. And that was, an exceptional case, and one in which Hershey is lionized for in the region where I live. Because it's just so extraordinary and is such a part of a particular culture of expectations of what a leader should do, leading an organization with, an industrial organization. But I walked that back a bit in an earlier episode in this podcast series, where I took a step back to think about, if you really had organizations providing that sort of a commitment, could it not turn into some means of control? And so I started to think about, if we're really thinking about, in the general case, what does organizational commitment look like? It's sort of like a supply-demand case where, you have the member's needs, and you have essentially three pools of resources, if you will, that we would anticipate the member drawing upon to provide for their needs. It could be the member, him or herself. It could be the organization, or it could be the society, generally through a government, to provide for those needs. Anyone within a society is drawing from resources in all three parts. It's just that there are all sorts of considerations in terms of what a society or what members or what the organizations consider to be the appropriate balance of who's providing what to service the members' needs. It's complex because obviously all members' needs are different. And it's even more complex when you add families. Because on the one hand, there's needs that the member has for him or herself. And the expectation or the contract, if you will, between a member and an organization might look like it is associated with, the member's commitment to the organization, the capacity or the duties and responsibilities might dictate what the organization should provide to the member. So if you're in a high-risk profession, well, of course, you know, the organization probably has or incurs a greater responsibility to ensure the health and welfare of the member. If it's a low risk, then maybe it's not something that the organization necessarily has to provide in total. Maybe some of that burden is put onto the individual. And of course, there's politics in this too, and I don't want to belabor this point, but you can have then, on top of this question of the mix of resources against needs, you can have a view that says that the majority of these needs should be taken care of by the individual member, him or herself. And then there's the opposite view that says that, well, no, for equity or fairness reasons, you should have greater government provision of the needs to ensure that everybody gets an equitable amount of service and that the needs should be aligned with what is considered to be fair across the board. So one model looks at much more independence and self-reliance. Another orientation might look at fairness. You know, so far I've still kind of concentrated on just the individual, the individual member. It gets a little bit more complicated, as you can imagine, because when we start bringing in the dependents, the organization has, you know, every say-so about who the member is. But then when you start introducing families, things do get very complicated. In a few areas, you know, this notion of who's taking care of the member's family is becomes a point of contention. And we're talking about tremendous expense. Let's take a couple of points. I'm going to use healthcare and I'm going to use paternal leave as sort of like two examples of where this gets very complicated. Healthcare is the simpler to discuss, but it's obviously a very complicated issue. Because we're talking about money, and the costs are of the big concern. For example, I checked up some statistics, and in the United States right now, the cost that a company has to pay for a premium for, say, a single member is roughly about $7,000 a year. For a family plan, it can be, on average, about $20,000. And the sensitivity of health coverage is significant because it becomes almost, for some people, it's been shown to be even a more of a driver of, you know, who and how one gets employed, even more so than the salary. The health benefits are really critical, especially now if we start talking about cases where you have families with special needs, where the cost of taking care of the special need, regardless of what it is, can really escalate in a hurry. And this is especially important for families who have children that require medication to be administered routinely. The concern that the organization has is, you know, what is it that they can do to try to control the cost? Companies don't always have a lot of leverage when it comes to negotiating such programs with the insurance companies. So when we talk about increasing needs and increasing costs and all that, it gets very complicated in a hurry. The question becomes, whose burden should it be? Is it, say, better served, in order to put it as a public function, to put it all under the government? Or is it better done by the organization as a permanent feature of an employer-employee relationship? Or is it, you know, put it back onto the individual, which runs the risk of individuals not being able to provide for their own needs or who don't have the capacity to find their own healthcare solutions? To my mind, there's just simply an open question as to, you know, what really is the no-kidding cost? The real cost of providing healthcare to an individual, and what are the needs? I mean, what is on average the actual needs of an individual over the course of their lifetime? We can debate all we want about which bucket needs to be the one doing the provision, or what is the most cost effective, or what have you. it's hard to really come up with some concrete answers until we really understand, you know, what is it that is considered to be a real, no kidding, proper level of care. And I certainly don't want to try to answer that, because it's hard to discuss this issue without a sense that somebody is making a decision to deny some level of care to somebody. That's something that we just don't find culturally acceptable. You know, as long as the demand signal exceeds the supply, regardless of what the buckets, where the buckets fall, this is going to continue to be a very, very difficult issue, because, you know, no one in this equation wants to take a disproportionate amount of the load. Too much of our focus on what right looks like looks too hard at the means first, and a little bit, you know, insufficiently on the ends, except adequately enough to just define what, you know, what would what makes sense for the distribution of means. Okay, and then the other one is parental leave. It almost runs up against a sense of what do we consider to be fair and equitable in terms of membership within the organization. The whole idea behind ensuring maternal leave and parental leave and these sorts of policies are aimed at trying to make things as equitable as possible, so that, say, a woman who becomes pregnant and has a child has some assurance of protection against losing their employment. You know, I think about the way that school districts around where I'm at accommodate very well the fact that many teachers are of young age. Many of them in the elementary school systems are women, and therefore you have a lot of pregnancies, a lot of births, and it's just it's a common occurrence that the districts will accommodate through what we call long-term substitute teachers. But not all organizations are set up to accommodate this way. And there is discussion about whether or not these sorts of maternal or parental leave policies actually work. For example, there have been studies done in Northern Europe and Iceland in which parental leave policies were reviewed in instances where organizations or the societies took a very severe economic downturn. In which case, if you had a couple, and this is in the case of a parental leave policy that gave equal opportunities for mothers and fathers to take time off to care for their newborns, well, what would happen is that, contrary to the idea of promoting equality through the policy, that the tendency was to revert back to something resembling older gender roles, in which the male would simply forsake the leave altogether, and the female, the mother, would go ahead and take the leave and provide for the children. And then you really haven't accomplished what you thought you would accomplish through the policy. So the lesson is that equality, it's a very fragile thing. Under crisis, old habits very quickly creep back in. So in this regard, you know, there definitely is a lot of questions out there in terms of what do we really want, you know, what does right really look like in terms of the organization's commitment to a member and families. A lot of it comes down to resources and risk. So we can take sort of a political / ideological stand that says that society and organizations and individuals have some sort of a profile that says, under ordinary circumstances, this is sort of what the right alignment or the right mix of resources, you know, where they should come from. But then the individual's needs is definitely not a stable construct. From not just, you know, the risks to the member, health risks, whether it's on the job or off the job, you know, there's always the chance that that a worker can be become injured or severely sick, which changes part of the equation. And then there's, you know, the whole additional thing about what is appropriate when it comes to the families. So now the guiding question is, what's appropriate? That's a question that's, you know, really difficult to answer. And it's not one that we really want to talk about because we don't, you know, we are uncomfortable telling somebody that, you know, that their needs are inappropriate or that they say that what they need is not going to be provided. We as a civilized or a democratic society don't want to put ourselves in that position. And the fear I have sometimes is that we won't answer the question, but instead we'll slowly erect barriers to receiving what is considered to be appropriate services just on the basis of cost or other things, then rather than confront the issue or rather than establish what the real vision is, establish what right looks like. There is a lot to consider, and I don't know that I've answered a lot of questions in this one. I think it's going to be something I have to think about and perhaps revisit in a future podcast. But certainly what we've got to come to grips with is if we're going to answer what right looks like, we can either take it as far as what a general ideological side is to say this is what an individual should need and this is the buckets that would ordinarily be, you know, how the resources are distributed to provide for that. Or we may have to take a much more pragmatic view and, you know, basically take each individual member plus families as a case-by-case basis, which can be a challenge to try to build a system, especially if we're talking about government or organizations. It's a much more difficult kind of a question to be able to provide a system that will satisfy on a case-by-case basis when we're talking about societies with hundreds of millions of people. So I'm going to leave it there. We'll chew on this, and we'll come back to this at some point. This ought to be fun. And that's all for now. The views expressed are my own and do not necessarily reflect those of the United States Army War College, the United States Army, or the Department of Defense. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.